Welcome to Charity Chat. I'm your host, Rachel Conroy. I sat down with Becky Denny, founder and director of the charity Spark, to talk about how they are on a mission to help the charity sector do even more good. We talk about how showing legitimate impact is so important across the sector, discuss the similarities and differences faced by different sized charities, and try to tackle some of the biggest social and economic challenges facing us all right now. So here is Becky. I'm very pleased this week to be joined by Becky Denny, founder and director of the charity Spark, to talk more about how they're on a mission to help the charity sector do even more good than we're already doing. So how are you today, Becky?
I'm well, thank you, Rachel. Thanks so much for having us on.
No, brilliant. Very, very excited about this conversation, Becky. So if you don't mind by starting to tell the listener a bit about your background and what led you to founding the charity Spark.
Of course. So yeah, I founded the charity Spark in 2019, and it was a purely selfish response at the time of wanting to work freelance and flexibly. My husband was in the Navy at the time, he was a submariner, and we had just got married and we were sort of facing down the barrel of moving around the country, and I didn't want to start again every couple of years with a new employer. So I was looking at what I could do that was going to support me staying in the charity sector, which I absolutely love, but also having that bit of flexibility of location and things like that. Now, pre-pandemic, that was a consideration. Post-pandemic, probably far more flexible wherever you're working. But, you know, that's sort of history now, isn't it, really, in terms of how things have changed.
Yeah,
but back at the beginning of 2019, I set up, and I had been working as a development manager for an education charity, and I'd been in the charity sector for about 10 years at that time, and I'd worked at a number of different organisations, but predominantly always in that development space. So a bit of fundraising, quite a lot of doing the reporting and helping develop strategies. And so I kicked off working with in quite a traditional freelancer role, actually. So I was supporting a couple of different charities a day a week and supporting them with fundraising and strategy and evaluation. And then, as we know, lockdown hit, COVID hit, and I actually had a baby at the beginning of 2020 as well. So I sort of had this period of time when we were all locked down to kind of figure out what the charity Spark was going to look like going forwards. And I really love working with different charities and sort of getting that flexibility and diversity of sector across the sector. So don't specialize particularly in any type of charity. But what we could see and what I could see was that the opportunity there to support charities in these two distinct areas was kind of really apparent. So I always describe it like the charity life cycle. Charities exist bluntly to do more good every day. That's what they want to focus on. And anything that distracts them from that often feels a bit like a chore. But actually what charities really want to do is do their bit of good every day, whatever that looks like for them. So what we do is support them in proving that they do what they say they do, which is our kind of evaluations and impact measurement, and then using that insight to develop strategy that enables them to have transformative income generation and also to reflect everything they've learned about what they do and redevelop their programs or continue growing them to help more people every day. So that's kind of how we fit in. We're that sort of supportive group behind that wants to cheerlead and support people in building their own sustainable futures.
Yeah, that's great, Becky. And actually, before I go on to my next question there, I think what you said about your background's quite interesting. What do you think are the key learnings you took from kind of being in the sector yourself to kind of now being supporting the sector that you brought with you to the charity Spark?
I always worked in small and medium-sized charities. So I have been there juggling 101 balls and feeling pulled from pillar to post. Been everything from doing the postal mail out to a load of different trusts for flip the next day, running an event somewhere, or being on the ground in a project and working with our beneficiaries. So I get that tension, or particularly in small and medium sized charities, of there not being quite enough pairs of hands on the ground and really needing to be efficient and effective in what mm-hmm. you do. And I do find it's quite interesting now working with charities from the outside, that actually I can go in and say, I get it. I totally understand where you are, that you're sort of viewing me with, as somebody who might come in and give you more work to do. So just sort of understanding that tension, you know, of how busy everybody is, but also that sense of, you know, I'm in the charity sector because I actually love and think what charities do is incredible. I don't want to leave the sector. I think we've got a real family, you know, a family group, but it's really kind of working out how I can, you know, almost give people as much help as I can by perhaps not being in-house anymore and working with lots of different organizations. And then I've got a little team, there's four members of staff who each come into the charity sector again with their own experiences and backgrounds and desire to be part of something good. And so yeah, I think that's probably the biggest thing, is I've worked across different types of charities. So I started off in a little international development charity called Children on the Edge, and then I went into a public policy think tank and into a military charity and an education charity. So I've kind of got these four distinct areas that yeah. I worked across. And, you know, perhaps people would say, you know, maybe I'm a bit of a jack of all trades in terms of sector, but I love that. I love that kind of understanding that there are all these lessons to be shared and learned that aren't specific to just hospices or just children's charities. You know, there's so much learning that we can share amongst ourselves. And I think having worked in-house and now worked externally for the last 4 years, I can really see how that synergy, you know, how we can share those learnings and sort of be a more effective sector, really.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, I think, Becky. And you touched on it in your kind of first answer, but showing legitimate impact is obviously really high on the agenda of many charities. How do you support charities to showcase their impact at the Charity Spark?
This is a kind of really big area of what we do, helping people prove that they do what they say they do. And I often find when, you know, we go in to support someone with this, there's probably a fundraiser with their head in their hands saying, I've got to report to all of these different funders and donors, and they all want something different. And I'm just spending all of my time trying to work out what our impact is. And some charities, the bigger charities, might have an in-house impact team and research team. And that's amazing if you do. And for many charities, that's not the case. And it falls to someone either in senior management or in typically in the fundraising team to kind of narrate that. And so when we think about it, we're really trying to get people to think about not bums on seats data, but true impact and change that they're creating. So the problem is when we mark our own homework, we often say, you know, oh, we helped 500 teenagers last year. And I'll come in and say, that's amazing. What did you do for those 500 teenagers? And they'll say, oh, well, we did these workshops. I'll say, great. Okay, so you had 500 teenagers who went through 10 different workshops. What change did you actually create for those people? And that's the bit that we want to come down to. So you've got all your, you know, outputs, your activity, which shows you've been really busy, and that's phenomenal. And you might know in your heart that the change is there. You've seen it. You can see their faces light up, the confidence change, all that kind of thing. What we're doing is helping you capture that and then demonstrate it to say, no, we know that these people have become more confident. We know that we've solved these problems that we set out to solve. I remember sitting, doing an impact workshop and sitting with a director of a charity who was there, and he was a director founder, and he was obviously incredibly passionate about what he did. But he was quite cross because he was just like, I just don't have time. Why can't people just give me the money and let me do my job? And I said to him, you know, why did you start your charity? And he was able to, you know, really eloquently tell me why he started the charity, what the problem was that he saw and what he wanted to do about it. And I said to him, okay, so what does that look like today? Is that still a problem? And he was able to, again, very eloquently tell me why it was still a problem, what they were doing, what they had done, what they'd learned. And I was like, great, you've just described your impact. It's not as difficult as, so, you know, because so many of us fear. And I think that's because we make it too academic, really. You know, often it's a lot of jargon that people get tripped up by. So my big thing is going in and trying to simplify it as much as we can, make it part of the day-to-day mindset so that evaluation is embedded into everything. Because actually, if we're not evaluating effectively, how do we know that our busy work is actually being busy in the right place? And so that's sort of, you know, we support people to understand what they're trying to demonstrate, work out how they're going to measure that, so which tools they might use, and then build that into a framework where they say, okay, we can collect this information, we can analyze it, we can report on it, and I'm not so scared now. The other thing we tend to do is kind of get called in to do independent evaluations. So that might be a one-off evaluation of a project or a charity where we run the methodology, we kind of come in and we just sort of do focus groups and creative evaluation tools and that kind of thing. And the charity get a report at the end of it. And increasingly, we're seeing that's something that people are investing in from time to time, either because they've been given a grant to do it, or because they've realized that sometimes having that external viewpoint is really, really helpful. So yeah, it's for us, it's all about making it feel a bit more friendly and not so scary. But that what you get out of it at the end of the day is your beneficiary. So whoever you're trying to help, their voice has been elevated beyond that of your chair of trustees or anybody else that's shouting loudly about what you do, that you're hearing what your beneficiary needs and wants, and that you're able to use that insight to then further drive your programs.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting that, Becky, what I've kind of thought when you're talking there is, we probably, and I come from a fundraising background, we can probably be a bit guilty of, when we're talking about impact, using those very kind of quantitative measures that are put upon us by partners or by funders in that way. But actually, to show real world change, the qualitative is what kind of makes people really understand your work. And it's about bringing that balance together as well when you're talking about impact at your organization.
Yeah, you're so right. And you really kind of planning to have both is a really helpful place. So the quantitative side, as you've mentioned, tends to be what we lean to because it is a bit easier to capture. It might be easier through surveys and tick boxes, and it's very easily linked to the outputs. But it does only show you one picture. And the qualitative side, I find, is so powerful, because if you sit there and have a conversation with someone, you learn what you didn't know was a gap, or you learn something about a barrier that they're experiencing that, because you didn't even know it was a barrier, you could never have asked a question about it in a survey. And so having that real blend is so important. And I think people are often scared by the qualitative because it feels really time consuming. And it does. It does take a bit more time to sit down and run a focus group or to interview 10 people. But the power in that insight is so worth it. And then when you knit that together with your quantitative answers from surveys or from other kind of tools that you might choose, you get this really rich description of your impact, and it becomes a really powerful development tool for your organization. The other thing it's really useful for is then, and you know, I always encourage people to tell your beneficiaries, you know, share this with the people you exist to support. They are the people you should report to first, because often that helps people to engage with other services they didn't know existed, or to sort of link other people in. So yeah, you're completely right, it's having that blend and not seeing one side as, you know, oh well, we do a little bit, because actually that can sometimes give us a very narrow view of our impact.
Yeah, no, I really like that point about sharing with your beneficiaries as well, Becky. I think that's really critical for a lot of people listening, I would imagine, as well. From your experience, do you find that different charities you work with face different challenges? For example, do smaller charities have different problems they need solving versus some of the maybe bigger organizations you've come across?
This is such a good question, because I do think it varies. And I think sometimes smaller charities have perhaps people lacking in kind of the bodies on the ground or in the office to support them. And sometimes the challenge is I'm one person doing six people's roles, and these are all really, really important. But, you know, having worked in a bigger organization as well, I think you can also sit there in a big organization and go, well, we could deal with a couple more bodies in the office. So it's not always as cut and dry as we think that, you know, you've got lots of staff, so you should be fine and we've got none. I think probably that shows that a common problem is more work than we know what to do with. And you know, being able to prioritize as a team and as a charity. And that's probably common across all the charities that I see, is that, you know, the more able you are to meet the need, the more need there seems to be met. And so it grows exponentially. I think, you know, there are differences in the way that larger and smaller charities you know, struggle or have different problems or challenges. And I think one of the things that can be so powerful about a small organization that sometimes bigger charities struggle with is the agility that a small charity might have. So actually the ability to respond really fast and to make changes, and having trustees who are they're kind of almost as involved as the staff are sometimes, and can be great, can be terrible. I'm not going to say either one of those is good. So sometimes, yeah, some of the things that smaller charities can do within that flexibility and agility can be really, really powerful, that I've seen and experienced and working in bigger organizations where you struggle because you've got a really bureaucratic system to go through and lots of different departments that need to sign off on it. So I do think it's not always kind of clean cut, and there are definitely a lot of shared challenges. It doesn't matter how big your budgets are, typically the budget you need is still a bit bigger. And I think that certainly, you know, staffing and how we make sure that the appropriate people with the right skill sets are in are certainly there. I do think one challenge that I've seen with smaller organizations, and particularly with medium-sized organizations where I've kind of been trying to coach them through this, is, and this isn't necessarily, you know, correct for every organization, but we do have a bit of a problem with like low salaries, particularly in smaller organizations, where you want the best people in the role, but you're paying really quite a long way under the market rate. And of course, every penny is being counted so carefully, as it is in bigger organizations as well. But that infrastructure and understanding of having benchmarked salaries and a HR team and everything like that to support might be lacking in a small organization. And there's often a pain point. I worked with a charity recently who are, you know, turning over to sort of 10, 11 million pounds, but their wages were sort of still stuck from when they were turning over 2 million pounds. And then there was that discussion of, well, should they have even been there when you were at 2 million pounds or less? You know, it's sort of, how do we value, I think, across the sector, how do we benchmark and value people's expertise and salaries? And I'm sure you've had this as well, but so many times when I was working for a charity and now working with charities, people say, yeah, but how do you earn money? And I'll say, well, I'm paid for what I do, you know, whether that was a salary when I was in-house or now it's, you know, obviously, well, we're actually consultants and we get contracted and commissioned. And people are, but you work in the charity sector. And it's almost like this offence that you can earn your income in the charity sector. And I think that that has a lot to, you know, kind of be worked out. I see it, probably see it more acutely in smaller charities, but I know it exists in larger ones as well. I don't know what your experience is of that, and that kind of feeling of having to justify that you earn an income in the charity.
Yeah, I would say, I think it's becoming, I get that question less and less. Like, I don't know if it's like more understanding in the sector that, and we're being better at talking about the fact that we need salaries to operate. And I always like to use the case, you know, if someone says this and they talk about potentially, you know, some of the negative stories that are associated around, you know, charities and them kind of over communicating or doing things that they think they shouldn't with potential funders. The counter argument to that isn't there. Well, you need professionals in place in order to mitigate and to deliver. And ultimately, nowadays, I think in the charity sector is here to essentially solve some of the biggest issues in society. So we can't do that for free because it just wouldn't work. But yeah, I agree with you. I think the question's getting less and less, but the point around the, you know, the number attached to your salary, I saw something interesting the other day from a recruiter that was saying they're seeing the same roles that were being advertised about 13 years ago for the exact same salaries. So if you even just take a kind of minimum inflationary increase from that point, we're nowhere near that at all.
I think I saw that as well. It was something like a 30k salary, and now it should be 44,000, you know, just like you say, with inflation. And I think it is a challenge, isn't it? I had a boss, a CEO that I worked for once, who said, you know, if I want the best people in my organization, because then we're going to be running the most efficiently, we're going to have, you know, kind of the most creative insight. And he said, look, I can't pay corporate salaries. That's not what we do. We're not a corporate, we're a charity, and we've got to be mindful of that. He said, but what I can do is benchmark across. And he used to benchmark to the civil service. So, you know, he kind of used to say, well, we need to pay a good pension and we need to look after our staff, because then we're going to retain them, which is obviously a problem as well if you've got high turnover. And but also just kind of recognizing the value that people are able to bring. And if you're able to pay people, you know, what is a fair but not extreme wage, then they're able to invest that time without worrying into your organization. So yeah, I definitely, you know, I work with tiny organizations who have got, you know, just breaking that £100,000 income, and they're starting to think about their first full-time paid staff member. And you know, that's always going to be a consideration, you know, what they're able to pay their new CEO coming in versus what the cancer researchers of this world can pay their CEO. But I always compare it as well to a business. So if you were looking after a business as the CEO with a turnover similar to some of the biggest, largest charities we've got in the UK, then there's going to be an expectation of expertise, of, you know, ability in terms of financial prowess and leadership and management. And, you know, when, if you just took the word charity out and popped a business in and said, well, what would you expect the CEO of a business turning over this to be paid? It's going to be far, far more than most of these charity CEOs are accruing. And it's the same at any level, I think. So yeah, I mean, I think coming back to your original question, the challenges there are so similar that even when there are differences in how they're played out and the way that the smaller charities can perhaps overcome some things more flexibly than the large charities, but the large charities might have a bit more of a safety net in terms of public awareness and the impact that has on fundraising. You know, everybody's got something to deal with. And I think that the charity sector is so prominent, like you said, in the way that, especially at the moment with public purse and all these, you know, kind of cuts that we're seeing and the cost of living increase, that actually it becomes more important, more and more important to look after who we've got in the sector to try and keep that going.
Yeah, no, couldn't agree more, Becky. And we've kind of touched around this question, I think, in a lot of what we talked about, but what do you think is the current biggest social or economic challenge facing the charity sector right now?
Gosh, this is a good one. I think obviously it would be remiss of me not to say cost of living, but I actually think that there are sort of two angles that I've seen a lot of discussion around cost of living. So from my kind of observations, lots of people have been saying the cost of living is going to impact my charity because it's going to reduce the amount of money there is available for donors to give to the organization. But I think the impact that I'm seeing that is perhaps bigger than that for charities is actually the demand on services. So it's still being caused by the cost of living crisis. People have got less at home, they have, you know, there are bigger pinch points, more people are needing food banks than ever before, more people are at risk of homelessness than ever before. There are public service cuts that have removed whole swathes of services that are then being backfilled by the charity sector. So actually, whilst the money that's out there is a challenge for fundraisers, and we've seen trust fundraising become even more competitive than pre-COVID days, and almost by a doubling in terms of competition. I think sort of anecdotally, we used to say one in four trust applications were successful pre-COVID, and now the same kind of people that we're talking to you, and anecdotally, that's dropped to one in seven, one in eight. So that's competitive, as is the, you know, sort of what money people have in their pockets that spare at the end of the day. But I think that the biggest thing that I'm seeing is just this respond to demand. Like, how do we meet the need in our communities, whatever it is that your charity does? How do we meet that growing need whilst also facing the pinch ourselves? You know, we've just talked about salaries, and I had a CEO saying to me recently, I need to raise my staff salaries, but I can't. You know, they're really aware of the cost of living impact on their staff. And what do we do? And so there is that real challenge. But I think that demand in services, I can only see increasing at the moment, especially as we go into the next year and we're seeing, you know, some of the steady impact now of the interest rate rises that people have kind of held on for this long, but have not really got much more in the pot. So I think that is a really big kind of social and economic crisis wrapped into one. And the way it's impacting our charities and the way that charities are trying to plan for this is huge. You know, utilities, that sort of thing obviously is impacting the running costs of a charity, just to kind of keep the base that they were at. And then when you increase the need by double in some cases that I'm hearing, then you've got a really big problem, because you've increased the need and demand for the services. The costs to provide that are going to increase as well. So I think that that is a challenge. I think what we have seen is that some people are being, some funders and donors who are really responding to this in a specific way. But we know that as soon as anybody says they've got a cost of living fund out there, it's inundated. So I think the National Lottery's cost of living fund closed last Monday and demand crashed their service and completely knocked the website out for the rest of the day. And you think, oh, I think that's going to be a competitive funding.
Yeah.
So I think that that's probably it. And I suspect as well, looking at the next 12 months, we're going to go into a general election. We're going to probably, shouldn't put my hands, I like put my cards out there, probably have a new government, whether that's one colour or a coalition government. I suspect that, you know, I don't know. I wish I had a glass ball. But then we've kind of got that, also that challenge coming of what does a new government mean for us all, and policies and changes, and the fact that COVID and the cost of furlough is extraordinary, like the toll that's taking on the
Yeah.
It's not all doom and gloom.
No, it's definitely not. But it's all, I'm glad you touched on the staff as well there, because I think it is interesting, because ultimately, like, we read about, you know, say a nurse needing to go to a food bank, but actually some people in the charity sector are very similar salaries to someone in that industry. So the increased need on the services is sometimes coming from within the sector as well. It's not just about that. So there's a whole other thing about leaders, as you said, understanding the toll that that's taking on their staff too.
Absolutely right, and it's huge. And when I was setting up the Charity Spark in 2019, I was also running a food bank in Portsmouth, I remember sitting down one evening with a lady who was just distraught, and she was a nurse, and she's just like, I can't believe I'm here. And I said, well, you know, obviously we kind of talked to her through and just trying to give her dignity back in all of this. That's what she felt, you know. And we were really fortunate to have a really lovely space. We're able to offer hot drinks and feed, and she sort of had that privacy that she needed, but also recognizing there was a huge range of people sat around her, and you know, that actually it was, and this was in pre-COVID, like it was already affecting people that broadly. And I've certainly seen that working with some of the food poverty charities that we've worked with in the last couple of years as well. And I think that you're right, particularly that impact on our own sector staff. I think alongside that is the mental health impact, because whilst people are stressed about money, and there's also that, you know, when the demand is increasing, when we're seeing more and more people need our services and we're struggling to keep up with that demand, then there's also that impact on our own mental health as frontline workers and as, you know, broadly supportive staff as well, and kind of wider charity staff, of how do we do this? How do we come up with a solution that's going to fix this? And I think more and more across any size organisation, it's that sort of looking after our teams and looking at what we can do. We don't have a magic wand and we don't have a pot of money at the end of the rainbow, but what can we do that's going to make a difference into that team's lives. And I've seen lots of really creative solutions, sort of going to split working weeks and reducing the number of standard working hours without reducing wages, to give people like recovery time and that kind of thing. But, you know, I think it's just really important that we recognize that traditional model, pre-COVID model, is perhaps needs parking. and that we're not going to necessarily ever see that normal again, and we've got to sort of find what it looks like, but yeah, being mindful of that impact on our own staff is so important, and we have to be there, because if we don't, we'll see such high staff turnover, because people won't be able to stay in the sector.
That
kind of undermines that bit that is at the beginning. You know, what is it that we want to do is do more good daily, whatever our good looks like. And we need lots of things to be able to do that. Good staff is one of them.
No, definitely. I like what you're saying there about some organisations, you know, reducing hours without reducing wages, and that I would expect that output hasn't changed actually with them doing that either. So that's really interesting to hear. I think we could talk for another like 3 hours, Becky, but unfortunately, I'm not sure our listeners have that much time, as we know time is precious to them.
Yeah.
I think time for one last question. How can the charity Spark support our listeners in their work?
Well, we first and foremost want to sort of cheerlead as much as possible. So we have, you can find us at thecharityspark.co.uk. We've got a newsletter that goes out a couple of times a month, which has got sort of a spotlight on a funder, what we call Spark Change Tips. That might be a tip around fundraising or strategy or evaluation. And we share webinars and that kind of thing that we're doing. And then if there was work that charities wanted more support with, then they can get in touch through the website, through LinkedIn, and we're able, as I mentioned, to support people across that strategy development and insight-led strategy, with evaluation and independent evaluation there as well. But yeah, we, you know, I'm always open. You can book through Calendly, you can book a virtual couple with me, and I want to share knowledge as much as possible, not just mine, because I know what I don't know, as it was the wise owl said, always know what you don't know. But we have a really great network of people who are far cleverer than I, who that we can kind of point you in the direction of and get advice from. So we try and do as much as we can to provide free support where we can, because as we've just been talking about, we know that the pot of money at the end of the rainbow is getting lighter, but there are other ways that we can support as well, through commissioned work and through support for strategy.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Beck. It's been great talking to you today.
Thanks, Rachel. It's been really fun.
A big thank you to Becky for sharing her expertise. The majority of us are in the sector to have real-world impact, but sometimes the day-to-day admin of a job can make us forget this. Working to ensure that you are showing your supporters all the amazing stuff you've achieved as an organisation ensures that we're all keeping the why of working in the sector at the front of our minds. As the cost of living crisis continues to impact not only charity beneficiaries, but all of us working in the sector, it feels that charity salaries are going to continue to be a hot topic. It will be interesting to see if any collective change will shift perceptions in this area. Becky's time in the sector across various organisations has put her in a great position to be a friendly sounding board, so make sure you check out Charity Spark, and I definitely recommend reading their blog, which is on their website. So thank you for listening to Charity Chat. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode. You can find us on Twitter or LinkedIn to share your thoughts, or email us on charitychatpodcast@gmail.com. Please also do like and subscribe to the podcast so you'll never miss an episode, and share with any colleagues or friends who may be interested. I've been Rachel Conroy. Thank you very much for listening.